In any event, as we are here, you must also learn that I have reached what I call my anecdotage. And that means that I am very fond of recalling anecdotes. You know the way it is. When you're in advanced age, you remember with the greatest of details things that happened long, long ago. And of course, you don't know what the heck happened yesterday. So I'll start with an anecdote. The year was, I think, about 1949 or thereabouts, and I was sort of marooned between countries in the Austrian Alps, being somewhat bored with everything because the natural beauty of the countryside is never anything that engages me for longer than probably 8.5 minutes. Actually, I was living in a place that is very famous with tourists in Hallstatt in Upper Austria, but in any event, I was bored greatly. And so I managed to get hold of a service that was selling used books by the mail, and I ordered a few books, and one book that came in the German language was a book by a long-deceased Russian lady, Helene von Shevich. And it was entitled, I'll give it to you in English, How I Found Myself. Helene von Shevich was an early member of the Theosophical Society. She was Russian. She was married to a Romanian prince. And in the book, a major portion is devoted to her meeting and interacting with H.P. Blavatsky. I knew something about Blavatsky by then, but not a great deal. But reading that account, I was utterly charmed. Maybe I didn't fall as much in love as my friend Michael Gomes, but you know how it is. He is of Portuguese Latin descent, and you know, those people fall in love in a really big way. Hungarians like myself are a little bit more subdued about it, but in any event, once I read that, I came across these various statements by the author saying, for instance, that when she came in for the second or the third time to visit H.P. Blavatsky, and Blavatsky just looked at her and said, why do you want to have anything to do with me? I'm just an old hippopotamus. And, you know, all kinds of really sort of weird, self-deprecatory, funny remarks. And it really appeared to me that there is a person of great humility and at the same time a tremendous sense of humor. I'm sure that you are not particularly interested in that, but I'll mention it just the same, because, you know, this is an opportunity when I can do that. But in any event, you know, I brought the book with me to Los Angeles, and then I met Madame Blavatsky's great nephew, Boris Dezirkov, who lived there and who was the editor of her collected writings, a very wonderful gentleman. He spoke for us at Peasant Lodge many times. And he knew that I was, my German was good, and so he asked me, did you ever come across a book of How I Found Myself by someone von Schewitz? I said, yes, I have a book. So he really wanted that book and couldn't get hold of it, and I gave him the book as a present. So for many, many years I didn't possess it anymore, but just recently somebody who knows German and who knows the book trade brought me an other copy, and somehow I feel that we've come full circle. Now once again I have the book that made me feel so excited and so much attracted to this incredible, magical woman, Madame Blavatsky. And so I brought the book with me. Now, as we address ourselves now today for the third time to the life and the person and the message and the activities of this astonishing woman, Magus, as I like to call her, Magus being in the masculine gender, we need to keep in mind, and perhaps in that respect I'll be able to take a little bit of a different look at her tonight. We need to keep in mind several factors that worked into her person and into her work. The first one of these, which obviously we have touched on, my great colleagues this morning have touched on it, that she was the representative, we might say, of a not just a particular teaching, not just a particular philosophy, or even of particular mysterious beings and people, all of which is true, but she was an organic part of a tradition. This I will mention a particular feature of that tradition tonight. And tomorrow I intend to go into some of the more specific contributions and approaches and teachings of that tradition. This is a very important issue because we come out of religious milieu in the monotheistic religions of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, where the prophetic role, in one way or the other, is always very greatly emphasized. And so we have a natural tendency to approach a spiritual teacher in the light of their uniqueness. In a sense, you know, this particular approach, this particular message, whether it's of a Zarathustra, whether it's of a Moses, is theirs, you know, alone. There's nothing really much before, and maybe sometimes something after. So we look at them as the unique fountainhead in time of certain teachings and of certain ideas. And we neglect the very strong possibility that there is both in terms of the message and in terms of the source of the message, there is a long line. When Blavatsky says, as it was quoted earlier, don't break the chain, that chain may also be understood as what in the Middle Ages was called the Aurea Catena, the golden chain, the golden rope. And this is the tradition. Now, there are various ways of looking at that. There is various ways of explaining it. And I intend to go into it in some detail of a different kind tomorrow. But right now, I will just mention one very important overall characteristic of the tradition. Incidentally, I think it was Dame Frances Yates, probably, who named the tradition the alternative reality tradition. Or it may have been Kathleen Rainey, wise old English lady of one kind or the other. No, it was Dame Frances Yates, the great historian who made really her name with her great book about Giordano Bruno, Giordano Bruno and the Hermetic Tradition, and a whole number of other books afterwards. And some of you may be aware that there was always some mysterious link between Giordano Bruno and Dr. Annie Besant, whatever that may have been. Annie Besant gave two magnificent lectures at the University of Paris about Giordano Bruno, which probably is available in the library here. When you read that, you will participate in the enthusiastic, intimate knowledge that she had and that Annie Besant had of that. In any event, it was Dame Frances Yates who named this as the alternative reality tradition. This has been endorsed by various scholars, and that it's as good a term as any, and it's really based on this notion that there are really sort of two realities in our experience. One reality is the external reality, what appears to our senses, what we see with our eyes, what is heard by our ear and otherwise contacted by our senses, the impressions that come to us from outside. This could be named the tradition of the external. The external reality has its own tradition. Within the context of our cultures, there are really two sources of that. One of them is the monotheistic religious matrix of Judaism, Christianity, Islam, and perhaps before that even Zoroastrianism. So that is the foundation of the external tradition. Why is that so? Because the prophets are there and are being addressed to by a God who is external to themselves and who gives them teachings and tasks to perform outside in the world. So this is the first or the external tradition. But as Francis Yates pointed out, there always was in this world another. And that is somehow usually followed and endorsed and practiced by fewer people than the external tradition. And that is the alternative or inner reality tradition. Our good friend and the resident scholar of the Theosophical Society, my longtime friend, Dr. Robert Elwood, previously from the University of Southern California, has endorsed that statement in many of his books that indeed there is an alternative reality tradition which addresses itself to a reality that is different from the external reality with which the prophetic religions treat spirituality, and then to it we can add also much of the classical philosophical tradition that comes to us from Greece, especially Aristotelianism, where, you know, Aristotle's statement as translated into Latin, and I'm not going to bore you with the Latin, there is nothing in the intellect that has not been in the senses. So our reality that arises in our consciousness, in our mind, all has come from outside. So on the one hand, we have the external God who tells people what to do, or more importantly, what not to do, and what to believe, and so forth. And on the other hand, there are the impressions upon which, with the ratio, with what the Theosophists often call the lower mind, we reflect. And these are really the two components in our culture of the external tradition. Now, the alternative tradition, however, has less clearly discernible origins, and yet it has always been there. And it always carried a certain great importance. Scholarship opines, probably quite correctly, that its origins are in phenomena, for instance, in the early archaic period of humanity, as shamanism and others. And why is that? Because the alternative tradition, unlike the external tradition that I mentioned a minute ago, the alternative tradition originates within and depends on the altering of consciousness. The external tradition can depend on the senses, and it can depend on the mind to evaluate the impressions and the logic and syllogisms and all that sort of thing. But consciousness has to change gears. Consciousness has to change. Consciousness has to be different in order to touch the alternative reality. That's why it's alternative, because it's not ordinarily available. And so you might say that there is an opening, there is a door into the other reality, which the reasoning, logical mind, and which the world of the senses has no concept of. It cannot enter. Manly Hall, whom we heard such wonderful, enthusiastic account today, very, very correct. Manly Hall was one to use the metaphor of Moses in the Old Testament to somewhat indicate this sort of thing. He said, just like Moses can lead the people of Israel through all kinds of territory and all kinds of adversities and difficulties, but when he comes to the boundary of the promised land, he cannot go in. And it is up for someone else, Joshua, son of Nun, who then takes the people into the promised land. In the same way, the logical mind the reasoning faculty can only take us so far. It can take us right up to the boundary of the other, of the mystery, of the world of ineffable greatness. But then it has to stop, and then something else takes over. World of classical antiquity and also in late antiquity, where really the foundations of much of our alternative traditions rest, that is sort of in the first, second, third, fourth century, where the three-leaved clover of esoteric schools existed, namely Neoplatonism and Gnosticism and Hermeticism. We have touched on them before. There was a recognition that the human, now this is a sort of recension into a much abbreviated form of Madame Blavatsky's system of the seven of the sevenfold nature of the human, beginning with the physical and, of course, leading clear up to the spirits. These folks said there is body, there is soul, and there is spirit. The body has the senses with which to recognize external reality. The soul or psyche, which is composed of a sort of mind-emotion complex, has the ability to reason and has the ability to emote, but then there is something else. And that which is beyond the human personality. And it is to that part, that principle of the human being, and to the reality which it discloses, that the alternative reality addresses itself. Now, there are some common features of the teachings and of the worldview, which the Germans call Weltanschauung, that is derived from the alternative reality. And some of those I intend to enumerate and perhaps explicate to some extent to you next time. In any event, I wanted to impress on us as much as possible that Blavatsky is, without any shadow of a doubt, one of the great representatives, the great messengers of this alternative tradition, and that she has to be regarded as such. The alternative worldview is also, if I may use that term, magical. Magic, the word magic being related to and derived from an Indo-European word, the root of which is M-A-G, and which has to do with greatness. We have such words in the English language like magnitude, magnification, and so forth, and it really has to do in its true sense, with the enlargement of consciousness in such a fashion that it will reach into and profit by the alternative reality. Madame Blavatsky, in some of her works, warns greatly against magic. What kind of magic does she warn against? Well, the personalistic, silly kind of magic, which has to do with hexes, has to do with love filters, has to do with, maybe also with how to influence people and how to get rich. sort of the origins of the optimistic all mind doctrines that had such a great influence in America, and that Mitch Horowitz wrote about and talked about so eloquently. So you're there too. And you have the let's say the higher magic of the American philosophy has to do with something very commendable, and that is an ultimate optimism. That if we get hold of our resources within, if we work hard at whatever we are working at, if we are well-intentioned, and if we are well-informed and well-inspired, then things will go well with us. And whatever we put our minds to will succeed. That's the higher magic of the American psyche, and about which Mr. Horowitz wrote that very, very wonderful second book of his. And on the other hand, there is also the lower magic. And what is that? This is actually one that Mr. Manly Hall warned against very eloquently in the great big book, in which is, you know, the subtitle of it, Mr. Horowitz did not mention, it's called The Encyclopedical Outline of the Hermetic, Masonic, Kabbalistic, and Rosicrucian Symbolic Philosophy. That's the title, you know. This is a chapter, and there are these wonderful illustrations by a terrific artist who was a friend of Mr. Hall, J. Augustus Knapp, who has the big pictures in the book. Mr. Hall in the chapter of magic says, well, he says, yes, there have always been black magicians, but he says, nowadays, if you want to know where the black magicians are, it's among the people who want to use mental and spiritual powers for personal ends. He was very, very opposed to the sort of the corruptions of the New Thought metaphysical movement for the attraction of wealth, the attraction of health, and all the rest of it. He felt that the American philosophy has gone in the wrong direction. That has always existed. People always wanted to get little goodies for themselves by other than ordinary means. And that somehow enhances the attraction of the goodies. If you got it by reciting a magical formula, burning a particular incense, sacrificing a certain kind of black chicken, a black pullet, you know, or something of that sort. But on the whole, the magia of old had to do with the enlargement of consciousness, the extending of our consciousness into the greater realm, and thereby, magnifying it, as it were. Now, I think I said enough about the alternative reality tradition, and I intend to deal with it in a somewhat different way and in greater detail next time. Now, enter Madame Blavatsky as a representative of the alternative reality tradition, of which she was certainly the greatest pioneering representative in the 19th century, perhaps in several centuries, including the 20th, including the 21st. Now, the rest, probably pretty much the rest of our time, such as it is, and when my time is up, I hope that you will start throwing things at me, vegetable materials, pieces of cabbage, things of that sort, you know. In any event, the rest of our time will be really devoted to asking and trying to answer the question, who was she? Now, first of all, and of course, we have heard very wonderful and very eloquent accounts a little while ago, she was a woman. And that says a lot. I've been around this world long enough that I know that woman says a lot, okay? she overcame the limitations of that her gender imposed on her and that the society into which she was born and where she was raised imposed on women, and she became an independent, completely sovereign, fiercely individual person in her own right. And that is certainly extremely important. She was, as we have heard before, she was the child of a military officer, Peter Alexeyevich von Hahn, who was the regimental commander of a Cossack regiment, and that her mother was a literary genius who, let's say, was much more affinitized to writing books than to raising a little girl. Her grandmother, Princess Helena Dolgoruki, by whom she was to raised, she had, in spite of these difficult conditions of really not having had much parenting in her time, she had a magical childhood. She had without a doubt, she had contact from early time on with Russian shamans, with holy men, and with the Kalmuk Buddhist lamas who came in from Siberia. Her contact with these people undoubtedly impressed her. But what the contact did to a major extent is it evoked in her the powers, the potentialities, the aspects of her character which resonated with the consciousness of these people. It's quite important, if at all possible, and I think it's pretty much possible for all of us, to have contact in our lives with people who know something deeper, who understand the deeper mysteries of life in a profound and powerful way. Because if we do encounter people like that, the likelihood is that we will in various ways try to follow their example, and we will also become, as G.R.S. Mead called the Gnostics of old, we will be the knowers of the things that are. Through all of these contacts, she was herself. And she never was really taken care of. She never was supported by anyone. She was essentially opposed to marriage, as you know. The marriage that she had was a very brief duration. So here was a woman who stood out by being herself, by taking care of herself, both physically and spiritually. Secondly, she was a rebel against society as she found it, against religion as she experienced it, against conventionality and hypocrisy in all forms. Her birth in high society had a certain amount to do with this. The ladies of the high nobility, of which she was really one, had a much easier time to rebel against the very system that put them into a very good position. Why? Because they had it, they didn't seek it. This is the way things often are. You will be able to renounce whatever you want to call it, privilege, special treatment, once you have it. Then when you don't have it. When you don't have it, you can't renounce it. this is a very important subject which doesn't quite belong here. But it shows that, she could dispense with what really her society had offered her because she knew what it was, and she knew that it wasn't all that great, and that there were, she intuited that there were greater things than that. Some of her biographers, and I think it's been rightly said, that up to this day, it's very difficult to find anything resembling a truly good biography of Blavatsky. In fact, I at the cost of making him blush, I will mention something about our good friend Michael Gomes. The first time I heard about Michael Gomes was in Crotona, in my dear California. And I heard it from Joey Mills. This was quite a number of years ago. And Joey Mills said exactly this. You know, there is not one decent biography of H.P. Blavatsky. And then she stopped and she said, there is one man in New York whose name is Michael Gomes. I'm afraid she mispronounced it Gomez, because that's our California Spanish way of putting it. Now, there is the man who is really qualified to write her. He's the only man who is really qualified to write her biography. And it stuck in my mind, I wonder, maybe someday I'm going to meet that man. So there we were in New York. You know, on a cold day, I was coming down the steps from the New York Theosophical Society, and there was this gentleman with dark hair and flashing dark eyes coming up the stairs. And he introduced himself, and I introduced myself. It was Michael Gomes. And there we stood on the stairs in the cold wind. I counted the minutes. I think for 57 and a half minutes. Why? Because we got into talking. there is the man who really has the biography of HPB in his head. But the other people, I don't know, Marion Mead, I shouldn't even mention her, and various other modern scholarly biographers, they were all, they were all writing her biography largely from the outside. They did not discern the incredible soul, the incredible spirit that inhabited her. The those who are within the alternative tradition, when they are evaluated and judged by people who have no real knowledge of that tradition, they don't know what it is, they don't sympathize with it, they inevitably misjudge such people. However, I think we may take some comfort in the statements of Mr. Horowitz, who seems to indicate that along with many people, many figures and many subjects of the of esoterica, HPB is again also being viewed with a great deal of more favor and more understanding at the present time by many people, including the scholarly world. Speaking of that, thirdly, she was not a formally educated scholar. We mentioned that before. But she was an inspired person of knowledge. She was, after all, a very talented writer, and as we have heard, a tremendously industrious one. Essays, books, poetic inspirational works, even fiction. She wrote and was published in several languages, especially Russian and English. She was an excellent conversationalist, a raconteur, I suppose one should say raconteuse, being of the feminine gender. She could be extremely dignified and formal and totally informal. She was a versatile, fascinating companion. She painted, she played the piano very well, and was, let's say, an all-around wonderful person in whose company you like to be, until you crossed her. Of course, considerable fury could erupt, and those people who were close associates, like Colonel Olcott, remained her close associates because they could put up with all that. In that respect, I might as well again throw in a little anecdote. When I, as a very young and brash individual, came to Hollywood and to the Hollywood Theosophical Lodge back in the early 50s, middle 50s, there was a very interesting gentleman there by the name of Henry Hotchner, very important member of the society and of Wesson Lodge. Now, he was very very energetic and talented man in his own right. But one part of his claim to fame was that he had been married to a lady whose name, prior to the time that he married her, was Mary Rusak, who was among her other talents, she was a seer and a sensitive, somewhat, let's say, like at a later time, Dora Kunz. She also quite early became associated with Colonel Olcott and went with Olcott to India, and she acted as his secretary for quite a number of years, and she was present at the what's maybe known to some of you as the Adyar manifestations at the time of the death of Colonel Olcott. And I will only mention one little part of that because miracle mongering is not my forte, especially when I did not witness the miracle. But let's see, Mrs. Hotchner, Mrs. Rusak did, but I'll just mention one of the astonishing events that went on when Colonel Olcott was on his deathbed, according to Mari Rusak, who was present, he was lying in bed. He was very weak. All kinds of strange things were happening. And all of a sudden, he rose in bed and he reached out, put out his arms, and he exclaimed, "Old horse, you have come back to see me after all." And it was H.P. Blavatsky whom he saw and who came to him, and his tears were running. So you see, even though he was yelled at and cussed at in English and in Russian, and I'm sure she knew very good French, because all the educated Russians spoke good French at the time. Those who stuck by her and who knew her really loved her exceedingly. She was an astonishing individual. Fourth, she was Russian, as we mentioned before. Russian, but with an American citizenship. And don't forget it, that she was very proud of being an American citizen. She many times in her life called attention to that, and that she was very happy and proud to be a citizen of the country of freedom. Even though she spent a good deal of her early life in Russia, and then no longer there, in many ways, in her psychology, she remained a true daughter of Russia, emotional, mystical, wild, capricious, and I don't mind saying so, I hope she won't mind, weird. Her weirdness and its potential was recognized even by such unlikely people as a Russian Orthodox archbishop by the name of Isidore, whom she met when she was quite young. And unlike perhaps other ecclesiastics who would have assumed that she was undoubtedly beginning to be in league with the devil and would do worse later, this old bearded prelate said that she had certain gifts which were undoubtedly given to her by God in order to accomplish something good. The opinion is growing that her main psychological strength must perhaps be sought and found in some of her Russian and Caucasian, in the sense from the Caucasus, character. She was what one might call, with a little bit of within a little bit of a paradox, a female starets. A starets is the traditional holy man in Russia. Star means old, and so the wandering pilgrims with deep insights and often unusual powers who wandered the countryside in Russia. And so somewhat she fitted that image, although she wandered all over the world. That she came to include a great deal of Buddhist and Hindu lore in her teachings is true, and was very eloquently presented to us a while ago. But I think much of her, the basic power came from her Russian soul. Why this was not emphasized much hitherto is there may be several reasons, some practical and others romantic. The practical, she spent a good deal of her time among Britishers, especially Victorian Anglo-Indians, and for that lifestyle and for those associations, I think right there we need to feel a great deal of compassion for her. They feared and hated Imperial Russia a great deal. HPB was under suspicion as a Russian spy. I think that has also been mentioned herself for a while. And of course, there were these wonderful scenes where she and Colonel Olcott would be traveling, and they were shadowed by an agent of the British Raj, who was to keep an eye on this Russian spy and her American companion, who, you know, being a former colonial, also was somewhat suspect. And so wherever they went, the plainclothes policeman would always be there. So Colonel Olcott felt sorry for him. He would go over and talk to him and hand him cigars. As time went on, they became quite friendly with him, and they told him, "Well, now you know, from here we are going there, and from there we are going here." It ended up being a fairly friendly contact after all. But she was being shadowed, so she had to play down her Russian-ness. The Russian establishment themselves were quite aware of what an unusual and very important person she was. I don't know how many of you have learned that, you know, Tsar Nicholas II, the last Tsar, God rest his soul, as a Tsarevich, as a crown prince, came to Adyar and visited there. Why? Because he said he wanted to see the place where his great and unusual countrywoman had been. So, you know, the Russians were quite aware of her. We need to keep in mind that she, let's say, you know, she had a heritage, probably a genetic heritage, of being different, of being unusual, of having an attraction to that which does not appear ordinarily. She had incredible, she had access, as we all know, to an incredible amount of unusual knowledge and unusual perceptions. You have probably read or heard some of these anecdotes, many of you, before, but some of them are worth looking at. You know, when she was writing the Secret Doctrine in England, she had a number of young disciples, the two cousins, Massey, for instance, and of course her devoted last secretary, whom we still revere, many of us, as the great translator of Gnostic and Hermetic works, G.R.S. Mead. She would send these people out to the British Museum and various places, tell them, "Look, I think in such and such a room, on such and such a shelf, there is a book. And if you open the book to a particular page, you will find there a certain passage, and you should compare that with what I have written last night." She had never been to that room. She didn't have any objective knowledge of the book, but she knew it was there, and she had somehow copied the text without being there physically, and she had the people verify such such passages. So this is also very important to remember. Her interest and her orientation and her dedication was of a totally universal nature. She knew that in India, in Tibet, in various places, the alternative tradition had a much longer period of open functioning without suppression and without persecution than the analogous tradition had in the West. This was one of the main reasons for her being that interested in and that well informed and using such a great deal of material from Indian sources, from Tibetan sources, and so forth. And I understand, in fact, I think the statement was made probably here, that His Holiness the Dalai Lama had called her a bodhisattva, which of course doesn't make her an inaccessible deity, but quite to the contrary, you know, a greatly illumined and greatly dedicated human being who did a wonderful work for the enlightenment of humanity. Lastly, but not least, I know I had a little. When I mentioned this in past years, I had a little bit of an argument about this with my dear and late friend Shirley Nicholson, but we straightened it out. Because I said then and I am now that if we use the term fairly loosely, she was a shaman. This was both her forte, her strong point, and it was also the area of her greatest strength. But in another sense, it was also her wound, her amphortas wound, her really difficult and sensitive side, her Achilles heel, her greatest area of vulnerability. Because shamans, as they are characterized by the great Mircea Eliade, who was mentioned before, from the University of Chicago, are not understood by people who are not shamans. And they're certainly not understood in modern society. They probably never will be. And why is that? Because these people have stepped out of the ordinary boundaries of human life. They have become miracle workers, thaumaturgs, and she was that. They always have been people who, because of the qualities of their soul and their experiences, don't fit into ordinary society. She was all of that. Now, and this is a sensitive point, the shamanistic character is also characterized by a certain amount of tricksterism. And this got her into trouble. Yet, and I need probably to be confirmed on that point by Michael Gomes and by Mitch Horowitz, this does not mean that the frauds that she was accused of, that she had really committed them. She did not. Most importantly, as Mircea Eliade pointed out, the shamanistic character is a hero of transformation. I think one of the terms that Eliade uses is a technician of ecstasy. The shaman is a traveler between the cosmic regions, the earth, the underworld, and the overworld. These qualities, as I say, were both her distinction, and they also sometimes got her in trouble. Her tragedy, which was really there, she, you know, all great people who accomplish great things spiritually or intellectually in this world are tragic figures. Tragedy accompanies greatness. If you come across people who are just happy all the time, you know, grinning and nothing bothers them, I would hazard a very educated guess that there is very little greatness in them. So now there can be people who can cope with their tragedy, you know, and who won't show it to you or don't rub it in. Oh, I'm a tragic figure. Oh, please come feel sorry for me. I mean, obviously she did not do that, but she had. She was a tragic figure, and one of her tragedies was that she lived among people who did not understand what a shamanistic, weird personality is like. They had no idea, as the plant says in the movie. They had no idea. What they wanted was a teacher. Nice, clean, scrubbed, mannerly, well-behaved and moral by their own silly standards, learned and truthful and honest in myriads of inconsequential and petty details. That's what they wanted. A schoolmistress, a schoolmarm, who would teach them how to be wise and, above all, powerful in occult ways. And you know what? She was nothing of the sort. Nothing. That's not what she was. She was a technician of ecstasy. She was a traveler in the inner worlds. She was a knower of the things that are, to use again G.R.S. Mead's expression. And they had no real attraction to that. They wanted a prosaic teacher for their prosaic souls. They wanted somebody like themselves, who just knew a little more than they did. Now, I am saying these things not just to be sarcastic, which is sometimes fun, you know. I mean, come on, you know, it is. But I am saying them because we all have these deplorable tendencies. We want to be associated with people as our associates or as our teachers or our superiors or whatever they are, who are just like us, but a little bit more. Because that little more, little bit we can cope with. But if it's a lot, then, oh, heaven help us. Oh, no. And that was, of course, that was part of her tragedy. She was different. As these unusual people, as the shamans of all ages always are, she did not just have knowledge, but she did not just have knowledge that was different from ordinary knowledge. but she was different. You see, she was a stranger in a strange land. Not only a Russian aristocratic lady bohemian of unconventional ways among rigid, alienated, self-conscious, arrogant, repressed Victorian middle-class people, primarily English. And I like the English, so you know, please don't castigate me for that. And Americans too, for that matter. People who didn't know the difference between appearance and substance. And with all that, with these great handicaps and obstacles in her way, she still managed to set hundreds and hundreds of their hearts on fire, so that no matter where they were, their fire never died. Even if they turned against her, even when they called her a fraud and a charlatan and a plagiarist and things like that, even then, secretly they knew that she had given them life, energy, inspiration, creativity, and above all, meaning. Even her enemies bore unintentional testimony to her greatness and to her power. But not all turned against her. We know that very well. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here. Otherwise, we wouldn't be in this place. Otherwise, we would have no society. Some sensed, some knew who or what she was. Few, even any, understood her, but they came to her. They received from her the fire of her unique charisma, and they carried it forward. Henry Olcott, the American Civil War colonel and lawyer, bearded, portly, cigar smoker, orator, healer, organizer, maybe a little bit pompous, maybe a little bit stubborn, but loyal and self-sacrificing to the end. He did not understand her, but he became the president of her society. He traveled and worked relentlessly, and even when he opposed her, he loved her and he revered her beyond all bounds. Judge, the Irish-American lawyer, tuberculotic, mystical, always impecunious, a condition of which I'm sure that none of you have any direct acquaintance. He struggled with circumstances in America and with his own problems and his health, but he knew that he had met the greatest thing in his life, and he would never let go. Annie Besant, the rebel, the social revolutionary, the feminist and socialist, the greatest silver-tongued orator of both sexes in her day, British to the core, but with a will and a mind that encompassed the world, who took one look at the aging, sick, tormented Blavatsky in a London room, and she dropped all her beliefs, all her friends, all her causes, all her involvements, all her dedications, and threw herself literally at the feet of the old lioness from Russia and served her cause in grand style until the end of her own days. And the others, Wilhelm von Hübeschleiden, the German businessman, scholar, right-hand man of Bismarck, spiritual father of, believe it or not, of the colonial expansion of Germany. I was well acquainted with his nephew, Paul Hübe, who lived in Pasadena and who was raised by his uncle, Wilhelm von Hübeschleiden. He was the great great light and leader of the Theosophical Society in Germany. Even after Rudolf Steiner went his own way, Dr. von Hübeschleiden took over again. And I tell you, his nephew, who was a Quaker and a Theosophist, you know, sort of interesting combination, why not? I would say the most integritous and truthful of people. Yet when we were alone together, and usually we spoke in German, which nobody else but my mother understood anyway, when we were there, he told me stories of experiences that he had with his uncle, you know, that are truly, truly amazing. It shows that the, well, you know, whatever, I don't want to go into that detail, but let's say the inspirers, the inspiring agencies of Blavatsky's work and the Theosophy extended to others. We know that Hübeschleiden had received Mahatma letters. They have been published. And things that the nephew, the young nephew, saw with his uncle were, I would say, truly of a miraculous nature. So this was another great, great and wonderful and devoted disciple. He was loyal and devoted to her to the end. G.R.S. Mead, the scholar, the translator of Gnostic and Hermetic texts, unequaled scholar in his field, who served her until the end and delivered the last oration over her ashes in May 1891 in London. And Leadbeater, the timid Anglican parson, who left his church, his career, his family, and his country to climb aboard a rickety ship on which Blavatsky was sailing for India. She taunted him and humiliated him and made fun of him all the weeks of their voyage. She treated him like a servant, but he knew who she was. He knew in whose presence he was. And he doggedly served her cause until his last breath, until they took him off the ship coming from India in Perth, in Western Australia, and took him to, I've been to the building where he died, and even there, all he could say to the others, to the Theosophists who surrounded him, my friends, carry on, carry on, carry on. And all the others, you know, hundreds and indeed thousands, poets, artists, scholars, journalists, clergy, politicians, statesmen, and the humble folk in all walks of life, you know, they all came. Her influence, both during her life and after her death, was far larger than even her most fervent admirers realize. And if indeed we have listened to my colleagues who spoke here before, it's not over yet. It's not over yet. The poet in those days, the poetry of Yeats, the music of Scriabin, the paintings of Kaczynski and Nicholas Roerich, the liberating work of Gandhi, the politics of Nehru, innumerable developments of culture, of literature, of philosophy, of religion, were influenced and stimulated and inspired by what this strange person started, and often by herself, by the, well, let's be very kind, portly. By the portly, funny, cigarette-smoking, tea-guzzling Russian woman who had the fire of the gods in her heart and a mischievous twinkle in her eye. It was easy to make fun of her, but ultimately she had to be taken seriously. What a woman, what a marvel, what a mystery. She was not even quite 60, I believe, again, my historian friends can correct me when she died. For the last, at least the last 25 years of her life, she was the very antithesis of everything that contemporaries expected from a so-called spiritual person. She was sick and diseased and ill-tempered, and she didn't give a tinker's damn for the sacred cows of contemporary Europe, America, or India. But she was somebody. She was somebody. She was herself. She was HPB. She followed her star. She lived by her vision, and she died for her mission. She was not schooled, but wise. Not moral, but authentic. Not well-behaved, but noble. She came from the aristocracy of Imperial Russia, and she joined the assembly of the nobles of the spirit. Our little discussion this afternoon chiefly concerned who she was. The reason for this is that what she did was the natural outflow of who she was. How many of us can say that, even to an extent, that our life, our careers, our deeds are really the expression of who we are? Or are we influenced by all kinds of, as she would call it, flapdoodle, and not be ourselves? Because, you know, there are levels of depth of the self. You know that very well. That's what her seven principles were all about. And so it's when we say ourselves, we have to continue to make the effort to get as deeply within ourselves as possible. So it's not a superficial self or an almost superficial self. Not our body, not our emotions, not our attachments and our prejudices, but deeply, deeply within the real self. There are few people who live that self. She was definitely one of them. Her many books, including her secret doctrine, the Theosophical movement which she founded and which is still here, and that's, I think, why we are here right now. The inspiration she passed on to innumerable devoted hearts and strong minds, all of these were and are and will be because who she was. And who was she then? We don't know. We shall probably never know. She remains the great and noble mystery. But one thing we can do, and that is that across the years, across the centuries, we maintain an honest and authentic attitude of thanks, of being grateful. What she did, the way she brought forth and worked for the inner tradition, for the alternative tradition, for the esoteric tradition, these are data, these are deeds that deserve gratitude in perpetuity. And so, concluding these little ruminations of an old theosophist, let me conclude by saying thank you. Thank you, Helena Petrovna. Thank you that you were here in a mysterious way, are still with us. Because what you left of yourself for us will never go away. It will never diminish. It will continue to do what you intended it to do. and we are grateful. We are grateful, and we thank you. And speaking of that, I also thank you very much for having been here and listening to my ruminations. So thank you very much.